low amount of current to the vagus nerve. So although technically the cuff around the nerve or the leads around the nerve may be stimulating, could theoretically stimulate 80,000 fibers, because we're only putting in a small amount of current, we're not seeing 80,000 fibers activated. But the fibers that turn off inflammation are activated. So we're not seeing significant side effects like slowing of heart rate or pain or off, quote unquote, off target effects. This is what has me so interested in this.
Just to follow up on how that works, you said that it turns off inflammation. Is it a binary system where you're turning it on or turning it off? I guess this is a way of asking why this works or how this works. Is there a way we can talk about that without getting too technical at the cellular level?
Well, we're still new in this. These are really important questions and ideas that you're framing. The way I think about this that has held up so far to 25 years of understanding, and I'm sure it could still be further refined or changed as we learn more, but this neural circuit controlling inflammation through the vagus nerve evolved over hundreds of millions of years. We've seen vagus nerve-like control of inflammation in roundworms and C. elegans, which are ancient animals, evolutionarily ancient and simple. We've seen it in all the mammals that have been studied, from mice to rats to pigs to humans. And so this is a highly conserved mechanism. So that's important as we think about this. The second thing that's extraordinarily important is when we activate the vagus nerve to turn off inflammation, it never turns it off to zero. It lowers the amount of inflammation. It doesn't immunosuppress. Now, the drugs we use, whether it's steroids or biologics that target TNF, IL-1, and IL-6, these cytokine molecules, these drugs are dangerous because they cause immunosuppression. The drugs block 100% of the inflammation whenever they can, whereas the vagus nerve stimulation only suppresses it 50 to 80%. So we're not seeing any immunosuppression. And from clinical experience now with 250,000 patients, give or take, who've had vagus nerve stimulation for epilepsy or depression or other conditions, we're not seeing immunosuppression. We're not seeing black box warnings. So there's a lot still to learn, but there's a lot of reason to be optimistic at this point based on what we already know.
Well, Kevin, I wonder if we could look at another way that electrical stimulation is being used to promote healing. And this is maybe tangential to your area of primary research, but significantly, DARPA, among other groups, has given millions of dollars to researching bioelectronic medicine around wound healing. And a lot of these grants have focused on so-called smart bandages. Can you describe how a smart bandage works? And do you see it as a promising option for using electricity to heal wounds?
DARPA has been a sponsor of my research over the past 25 years, and without DARPA's early support, I'm not sure this entire vagus nerve story would have been to the mature state it's at right now.
I think the unofficial DARPA motto is something like, imagine the world in 30 years and let's give it to you in five.
Yes. Yes. My dear friend and former DARPA leader, Jeff Ling, used to instruct his managers and his staff with the guidance of, yes, it's crazy, but what if it's yes? Now, I think that's where we are, frankly, with using bioelectronic medicine to treat wound healing. It's the early days, but I see a path based on deep scientific mechanistic understandings where one day we will be able to accelerate wound healing by using bioelectronic devices. And the reason I see this as possible is at least twofold. First, from what we know already, that it's possible to hack into nerves to control the nerve production of neurotransmitters. And we know that neurotransmitters can control the magnitude of the inflammatory response or the magnitude of inflammation. We should be able to take out the parts of inflammation that slow the healing and accelerate the parts of inflammation that help the healing. So that makes perfect sense to me. What I know not a lot less about, but see work going on and being described and published, is the role that individual cells use to communicate by modulating their electromagnetic fields that are either around or in the inside the cells. The best way, I think, for people to think about it in general, and there's been a lot written on this, is the fact that you can take a tadpole or other newborn reptiles and in the laboratory, and you can amputate a limb, and then by manipulating the electromagnetic field around the limb bud, you can control what kind of limb is regrown. And so it's clear that simply changing the electromagnetic field can change the response of stem cells and the healing process itself. And so this is clearly been done. And in order to transfer that to healing of wounds or regrowing limbs in humans, which sounds crazy, but who knows, if we understood enough about stem cells and understood enough about the electromagnetic fields that control them, maybe someday in 50 years, we will be able to significantly modify damage in adult humans. That this is what would be called the DARPA hard problem, but what if it's yes?
Well, we will keep our eye out for developments in this area. It just sounds so promising. Kevin Tracy, it is so nice to have you back on the program. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
That's Kevin Tracy, a pioneer in the field of bioelectronic medicine, talking about the potential of electrical stimulation to treat disease. He's a neurosurgeon and president of the Feinstein Institutes at Northwell Health in New York.
And that brings us to the big picture and our question: what is the potential of bioelectric medicine to treat pain and cure disease?
Yeah, well, I think the answer is we don't know the answer. We don't know yet enough to be able to fully evaluate what the possibilities are, but they certainly look promising because of the fact that, you know, the electric currents play a role in essentially all the functions of the body, including pain and disease and stuff like that. So if we can understand more, we can do more. It's like everything else in, well, medicine for sure, and applied science. The more you know, the more you can do.
And there's a possible parallel here. You know, we decoded the genome and then the microbiome, and now we're trying to decode our electrome. But if we do compare it to the deciphering of the genome, you know, Seth, we had a lot of promises that once we decoded the genome, it would clear up the mysteries of human evolution and give us control over disease. But the operation of those genes proved more complicated than we thought.
Yeah, well, for me, that's a familiar problem. It's like when I finally developed enough reading ability or vocabulary to read Shakespeare, but that didn't mean that I understood it, right? There's a difference.
And, you know, maybe Samantha Payne said it best when she said that we will continue to do experiments and we will find that some of them will prove to be more hype and they will join the long list of electric medicine going back to the 19th century that didn't work. And that's what it means to be skeptical around this new area of medicine.
It's also what it means to do experimental science. Most of what you try doesn't work. But, of course, that doesn't stop you from doing it because you know there is an experiment that will work.
This show would not be possible without the sparks of imagination from senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Thanks also to financial support from the Breakthrough Prize Foundation, Lauren Trottier, Rena Shulsky David, and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that investigates other bodies in the cosmos. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also, big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This Skeptic Check episode of Big Picture Science that examines the potential of electricity to heal the body is called Skeptic Check, The Body Electric.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.org.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. As we consider ecosystem service, we are moving toward a new method, an expanded system evaluation of the contribution of nature as species or habitat to financial analysis and understanding of true profit and loss when we use such services, conserve them or deplete them, as plus or minus on our economic balance sheet, as a measure of domestic product, and as data by which we declare policies, apply subsidies or incentives, and regulate the consumption or conservation of natural resources. It is mostly about the data. The invention of Excel as a tool for financial planning always seemed to me as a kind of illusion. The criteria and amounts selected for a budget, a magical function of selection, change the premises, thus change the conclusion, thus any budget can be made to balance, any analysis can be made to confirm predetermined conclusions. We use gross national product as our primary measure of economic performance, compare and contrast it, and adjust the components in order to promote continuous expansion and measure of growth. It is a formulaic arrangement of data, susceptible to what is included and particularly to what is left out. And so, to account for the true value of an ocean economy, of associated inputs and outcomes, we need to understand that the established premises, the conventional parameters, must be adjusted to reflect a full picture of an inclusive calculation as a basis for assessment and reassessment of policy, profit, and national viability. As the ocean connects all economies, such change, while a more accurate calculation of value, represents a radical upheaval of conventional structures and behaviors worldwide. A 2020 report by a World Resource Institute high-level panel for a sustainable ocean economy offered some revised definitions, questions, and pathways forward. It concluded first that the data required to inform the change was actually available, contained in disparate studies and government statistics. Thus, the primary obstacle was not inadequate information, but rather the resistance to the idea that product includes social inputs, that natural capital was an acceptable asset value to include in the calculation, and that income as social benefit was to be included in the formula. The report suggested three fundamental questions as a framework for change. First, ask how will a decision change the wealth of an ocean balance sheet, including all produced assets by ports, for example, and non-produced assets by coral reefs, for example. Second, consider how will a decision change net national income or welfare, and how will those changes be distributed between different groups of people. And third, project how the decision will change ocean-based economic production and create new means to achieve social and economic goals. The report went on to recommend an internationally agreed framework for revised national accounting to avoid over-reliance on traditional GDP and lead or contribute to collaborative efforts to improve national ocean accounting operations, devise systems of execution, maintenance and collection of statistics, incentivize timely transfer, reduce barriers between agencies and offices, establish new standards and different practices, develop cross-cutting platforms, tools, algorithms, and programs for data sharing, and new reporting tools applied to familiarize public and private leaders and legislators as a demonstrable commitment to change. The report makes for close reading, but the conclusion seems direct and simple. A. The data exists on which to include and base the change. B. The process is more a function of political will than illogical thinking. C. The oversight and legislative capacity exists to execute and surveil the new system. And D. The problem is primarily one of conventional thinking, vested interest in the old method, fear of change, and other resistance, even in the face of crisis, to a solution that would provide a context and justification for urgent strategies to conserve and sustain the natural and communal assets now threatened. Indeed, here, in the making, is a key action toward rescue. R for renewal, E for environment, S for society, C for collaboration, U for understanding, and E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 9 de junio del 2023. La emergencia pública mundial causada por el COVID-19 puede haber terminado oficialmente, pero la pandemia seguirá con nosotros por muchos años. Tampoco está claro que los gobiernos hayan aprendido lo suficiente del brote como para estar preparados para luchar contra los nuevos microbios emergentes que podrían desencadenar calamidades peores.